Good day, and thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Principal Street High Income Tax Exempt Quarter Four Investor Call. At this time, all participants' lines are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. To ask a question during the session, you will need to press star one on your telephone keypad. And please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Mr. Nick Henry. Sir, please go ahead.
Great. Thanks so much, Mel. Thanks, everybody, for dialing into our call today. I am Nick Henry. I'm the Portfolio Director on the Principal Street Municipal Bond Strategies team. And on behalf of Principal Street Partners and our distribution partners at Sky Point, we are pleased to be speaking with you today. And that we, to which I refer, is the Principal Street Municipal Bond Strategies team in its entirety, which is an exciting development in its own right. And that includes, all of whom are with me today on this call, but that includes Troy Willis, CIO and Lead Portfolio Manager, Joel Gulley, Director of Credit Research, and I'm happy to introduce the newest member of the team, Charlie Polleri, Senior Portfolio Manager, who came aboard at the start of the year. Like Troy and myself, Charlie is also formerly of the Rochester team at Oppenheimer and Invesco. We have gotten that part of the band back together with Joe and are very excited to be moving full steam ahead. The team is assembled and we're good to go here. Now, to set the table, GSTAX, the high income fund, begins 2022 with an extremely strong, I think, risk reward profile. You know, to sort of boil it down, we're looking at about a 5.2, a little, maybe even a little more higher than that, distribution yield, 6 years or a little under duration, and maybe around 2% leverage, which we think really sets up the fund to be able to you know, take advantage of opportunities in the market this year, which is what we love to do. So, Troy, why don't you take us through, you know, this sort of the big topic in the fixed income world, at least domestic fixed income right now, which is you know, the discussions about inflation, the, you know, hand-wringing and gnashing of teeth having to do with inflation and rising rates, what that means for, you know, the municipal bond market in general, for the peer group a little more specifically, and then the portfolio most specifically.
Yeah, so the year started out, rates basically just straight up, about 50, you know, basis points, close to that on the 10-year Treasury. Munis kind of underperformed a little bit as they had outperformed a bit at the end of last year. You know, everybody, we're in this rate cycle. Everybody's talking about the Fed, you know, raising rates. You know, one of our favorite topics du jour when, you know, everybody knows what rates are going to do. You know, we've set up the portfolio to be cautious, and, you know, we rewarded that here at the beginning of the year. But, you know, we're doing it while maintaining yield. We've done that by picking, you know, good credits and good structure, defensive structure, while keeping yield, diversifying credits across the board. So we've set up the portfolio, I think, really well to handle this. And now we can be, to me, you know, we trade off, the market trades off. Then you nibble a little bit. You take a few you take advantage of some of this volatility. Bonds that wouldn't be for sale get for sale. Things get a little cheaper than maybe they should. We think we're going to be up and down throughout the year. There'll be some rate volatility. But Charlie's going to talk a little bit about, you know, we've been through some of these rate cycles in the past where people think, oh, the Fed's going to raise rates, so bond fund, you know, I got to sell all of my fixed income and get out of bond funds. And we've seen that's just simply not the case. We've seen it for years and years. People are terrible at really predicting interest rates. Do I know that rates are not going up on the long end? I don't have a crystal ball. But what I do know is right now is a way better time to buy than it was at the beginning of the year or the end of last year. So that's, you know, I'm performing, we're doing that in the fund, you know, as we speak, things trade off, we buy some, things trade up, we're more inclined to sell some. We kind of keep it, you know, simple in that regard, don't overthink it. Charlie, you want to talk a little bit about some of the last couple of rate cycles and the numbers we've, you know, seen?
Yeah, yeah, more than happy to. You know, I think it certainly goes without saying that a rising interest rate on a fixed income instrument is bad in its most simplistic form. You know, anyone who's taken a fixed income graduate class or in some of the other studies that we've had to do throughout our careers, you know that if you have a 5% bond, but interest rates are at 6 or 7, the bond price goes down. And yeah, that is certainly true. But the narrative that takes hold every time we get through these cycles is just an emphatic Fed raises rates and it's time to run for the hills, and fixed income is persona non grata. And what we need to recognize is in actively managed funds, you know, they're a living, breathing entity of their own. And there's a lot of factors that go into what rates are doing, if you will, as I do my air quotes that nobody can see. And I'd say it's predicated on a couple things. You know, what is the discount rate for the bond or the pool of bonds in your fund, and how those interact with each other relative to what is essentially the talking point, Fed funds rate. You know, that's an overnight rate. That is the only thing that the Fed can control. And as we've gone through, you know, the last three of these hiking cycles, the last one being from mid-2015 to early 2019, and then before that, we all remember, you know, starting in mid-2004 to about early 2006, those are pretty steady incremental increases. And what was observed is a yield curve flattening. And so, yes, the Fed was raising short-term rates. But what was happening to long-term rates? And we can see in several occasions that this flattening and sometimes a bullish response on the longer end is driving the fixed income funds that everyone was so fearful of at the beginning of these cycles, because everyone knew rates were going up. Now, does that mean the backup in the market that we've seen in the last 6 weeks has been a positive for the funds? No, because discount rates are higher. But what we're looking at is specifically in G-Stacks, an instrument that has a tremendous amount of yield advantage and an active approach from the portfolio team in order to maximize what is the driving factor of that of the fund's performance. And that's going to be its distribution yield. So when we look back at 2004 to 2006, Fed funds rates went essentially from 1% to 5.25%. In that same window of time, the 10-year and the 30-year treasury were essentially flat. Now, granted, those are higher rates then, but so was the Fed funds rate, and this flattening is a natural reaction that the bond market typically has when a Fed is trying to slow down a hot economy. Now, when you have an economy that's strengthening, one of the things that's often unrecognized is the benefit that has to the credit sector, right? The reason why certain in the yield, the non-rated high yield sector, these are credits that, you know, we have to be selective when considering them, introducing them into the portfolio, and that there is a narrative that is typically project specific, but the tailwind from a strong economy is one that often benefits and strengthens the credit profile itself. And we will often observe things like liquidity risk premiums will tighten in these cycles, which is good. Risk credit spreads can sometimes tighten. Usually you have to have a keen eye to know which are the credits that will benefit most from that. So as we face this narrative, I'm going to say I feel more encouraged that there's opportunity to further improve the fund, especially while this narrative often claims many victims, even professionals in this market, sometimes that are having to respond to just net outflows in their funds. And it is an environment that I much prefer to put money to work.
Yeah, and just we've had, just so everyone knows, we've had positive inflows through the month of January into into the high income fund. So we're not in a position like some of the bigger competitors where they're in heavy outflows through some of these cycles. And that's a big benefit to our model and structure.
I think I think it's good to mention the powder in the keg you have when you're not entering into a cycle where prices have come down, yields have risen a little bit, and we're not leveraged to the teeth like many of those same competitors that are in outflows, where they're 30 and 40% levered in trying to maintain an attractive distribution yield, and we're able to do that and then some with minimal or negligible leverage.
Yeah, I mean, we were much more of a pure play on a duration. We're a high yield credit, and you've seen that how we operate. It's mostly credit. We don't think it's a good idea to take on a lot of duration risk right now, so we're cautious about that. And we've seen the benefit of that model. Now that times that could change, if things get cheap enough, that I'll take some. We'll take on a little duration risk here and there in the fund. To take advantage of some swings of volatility that we see, in the muni market. So the other thing I'd say is, in the long run, over a 5-year holding period, if you raise rates, 50 basis points a couple times during that time period, you will have a better overall total return as a fixed income investor than if they stayed, low or went down, right? In the short run, you lose a little in the NAV, but in the long run, you pick it up in income. And we're always income focused investors. We'd rather, pick up, income. If I could get, 6% yield and a 1 or 2% decline in NAV, that's better than, a 4% growth in NAV.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk about a couple of credit areas, which is more our wheelhouse. And a couple of areas to talk about is the big one is Puerto Rico. We don't own a lot, about a 3.5-4% position or so in Puerto Rico highways. When we took over the fund last year, we added that. It was I'm not generally a big fan of let's just say, to put it lightly, on Puerto Rico's willingness to pay its debts. It's very obvious they are not willing. I think they've had the ability throughout all the cycle to actually pay their debts, and the numbers keep pouring out that's in fact absolutely true. I believe the Puerto Rico bankruptcy is one of the greatest frauds, certainly in the last 20 years. And they're, we're going to run it through and get it done. So the only thing I've done is we bought Puerto Rico highways in the 30s. Now they're trading close to, they're right around 60. And that's another deal that'll get worked out. Most of these other deals, the GOs and the COFINA sales tax, right? The COFINA sales tax got done last year. The GOs and the PBAs are the deal that everybody's kind of talking about lately. That's going to get done. People are going to get new bonds. If you own individual bonds, you're going to get the new GO, which is the same as the old GO that they defaulted on. There are no extra credit enhancements in this new GO flavor. You're going to get a bunch of cash and some new bonds and a contingent value note based on these, based on the sales tax bonds. So that deal's getting done. So I am not a believer in Puerto Rico credit spreads right now. I mean, it's amazing to me some of the lack of yield that you're getting to lend in Puerto Rico after these new deals are getting done. I understand in the short run, with the oversight board in place, when they do new deals, they're not going to default most likely in the next few years, but they are not a good long-term credit, as they've clearly, clearly shown. So that's kind of the quick and dirty on our Puerto Rico. We also have some Puerto Rico tobacco bonds, but I don't really put that in the Puerto Rico bucket. Charlie, you want to talk a little about one of the big advantages of, we have a 6% position in Puerto Rico, but we have other New York tobacco as well. Tobacco bonds is an area that is interesting and have been helpful to the returns and fund over the last year?
Yeah, I mean, this is both Troy and I have been following and investing in MSA-backed tobacco bonds for, 20 years. And we've seen all flavors, and there's a lot of history to that sector, and not all bonds are created equal, and there's different, like I said, legacy flavors of them. One thing is there's a little bit of a scarcity value, nowadays on these older structures, some of the ones we still find attractive and appealing. And this is really kind of a victory lap, at least from a narrative standpoint, Troy and I often talk about, because for years we would speak to specifically the diversifying and the credit benefits of tobacco from a credit standpoint being unusual. You know, for those that are unfamiliar, the annual payments that are made to support these bonds are driven by two factors. One is consumption domestically in the U.S. Across the board related to prior years and the base year of the MSA. And that is trending down. And we've known that's been trending down for a generation and then some, and that's already baked in the numbers. One of the things that was often, I think, underappreciated, and we would stand on the mountaintops and cheer this, is there's actually an adjustment each year on inflation. In years that there is no inflation, the annual payment is increased by 3%, and that usually offset some or all on any given year of the consumption decline. But what was often missed in our market, and even by the NRSROs, those are the rating agencies, is this baked-in expectation that inflation was never going to be above 3%, not even for a day. And you know what? In 2015, 2013, 2009, yeah, sure. It seemed like that was a fait accompli. That's what everyone put in their models. And there'd be a year here and there where you'd pick up over three and you'd get, a little extra, 50 basis points, a full point of additional payments. But here is the example. We just lived through it last year. To some extent,
fact,
it looks like
in fact, Charlie, just for a second. In fact, we got yelled at by our bosses for our ridiculous modeling of putting 3.5 in, because we said there's going to be some year down the line where we're going to get higher than 3% inflation. And our boss yelled at us as being ridiculously unreasonable, and that was just a crazy assumption.
And we would look at rating agencies like Fitch, and Moody's and S&P. They would have ultra-conservative estimates for what inflation would be, again, no greater than 3% ever. And we just didn't think that was defensible. And here we are in this cycle where you're actually getting a boost to payments, and that was on the heels of 2 years ago, 18 months ago, 24 months ago, when there was actually an increase in consumption. So, these things that are sometimes mantras and certainties in the credit world, a keen eye is going to recognize when it's not. And again, a sector that we think is underappreciated always, although spreads at this point, are probably tighter than they have been in the past. But a lot of that is polluted by some of the newer tobacco deals that come that don't have nearly the attractiveness in structure that that we've added to the fund. But again, yeah. To have some line items in your fund that are going to benefit from a credit standpoint directly from inflation is just another diversifier that we can add.
Yeah, and we went out and bought these longer zeros that would benefit the most from these changes, right? So the you're actually getting now faster payments, increases in payments in on these bonds over the last couple of years when they were all expected to decline somewhat over the years. They were modeled and set up to decline at least 3% a year in payments. So we've actually had 2 years in a row now where they're increasing due to the inflation adjustment and actually slight uptick in consumption. So this has been a huge turnaround. We got those early last year, and they've been a big help to overall performance. Their long tobacco zero is yielding between 7 and, 8.5%.
So yeah, I was going to follow up with the yields on those, yep.
Another sector we talk about is, last sector we'll talk about, nursing homes, senior living area, which I know in prior, if you're longer holders of the fund, you've heard a lot about this sector. It's one of our larger sectors still in the fund. When you combine kind of all the different flavors of senior living, it's around 18% of the fund. We certainly had some, challenges and defaults back in 2020 and COVID and some of these areas. And I think this is a classic kind of muni value area where babies and bathwater, that people that do top-down analysis say, well, gee, I won't touch anything in the senior living area because I know all the older people are dying of COVID and beds are empty and, everything's a disaster. But there's a lot of different flavors of senior living, and there's an absolute need for senior living. This COVID stuff is not going to change any of that. We don't really have nursing homes. We have, assisted living and senior, CCRCs, continuing care retirement communities. And, we've been able to buy some of these at 5 to, even 7%. We bought some back in December, seven and three quarter coupon at 7%. Are they easy to find? No, but we've been able to, find some of these that are, they had a dip in occupancy for, a year or two, and then but good managers were able to handle that, and they didn't have massive losses, and they're able to cover the debt service as of, now already, and they're doing just fine. You've seen certain areas where it's already, bounced back. And then some of the ones that have defaulted are in areas, at least where we've already taken the beating over the last year or two. And now we're at a point where, some of the underlying real estate is, more going to be, we think, in most cases, more than, it was scheduled or thought to be, a year ago. So we think we're going to get, better recoveries on the defaulted ones. And, we've been able to find some really good values in this, space. And it's an interesting space. I went through this, father over the last, few months had issues. So, walking through it and it confirmed for me, you look at the amount of revenue that you're getting on a square footage basis for senior living. And anybody who's had to deal with this, it's a need that they have to, when you get a certain age, they got to move out of their house. So they're, and they're providing, nursing services and, there's a need for these and that's not going away. To me, in the past, I've always had issues with the senior living bonds in the muni market because newer projects I don't think they put in enough equity. So I thought there was a little too much risk in most new projects. And we've seen a couple of data points over the years that matter. So there are some new projects we invest in. There's one small one in California that we bought last year where one of the really important data points is how quickly the spots get filled up prior to construction, prior to the bond deal. So some of these deals, they're out marketing them for 5 years to try to get enough reservations to get to the point where they can bring a bond deal. So in those cases, we find the probability of default is extremely high. The one we bought last year, basically within a year, they were able to get 85% reservation rate really quickly up and running, which shows there's strong demand in the area, good management, good marketing, and the fill risk is very low in that particular instance. But for the most part, we have found that, a brand new project is going to borrow at 7.5%. We found it's better to wait a year and follow construction, and if construction gets done and they fill it, you can buy that bond at 6.5. While it's not the 7.5, you've taken 80% of the risk out, but you're getting 80% of the yield. So I've always been more of a focus on buying some of these projects a little after the majority of the risk has been sucked out, and then they make better value. Or, like I said, now buying them in a down cycle when everybody's worried about things. So there's been some good opportunities there.
All right, lots of good stuff there. Mel, why don't we start the Q&A queue, see if there's anybody interested in asking a question.
Certainly, sir. And as a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that will be star 1 on your telephone keypad. And to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Please stand by while we compile the Q&A roster.
All right, while we're doing that, one thing that I always get asked by advisors that you guys can comment on, and maybe I'll throw this over to Charlie, is what's your outlook for issuance in the muni market and maybe the high yield part of the market specifically this year? And, you know, is there going to be any impact from, you know, an infrastructure package yet or anything like that? But what does issuance look like to you for this year?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, putting a finger on that exact number is akin to forecasting interest rates. So I'm not going to have a number for you, but what I can say is what we've observed in the last couple of years is this continued cycle of net negative supply. You know, that's the new issuance each year and how that lines up with demand in the market coming from flows, maturities, calls, other redemptions. And the driving forces of those, even though we've seen decent flows the last couple of years into the market, has really been this shift where almost 25% of the muni issuance is coming as taxable. So that tax-exempt portion has declined and is not quite enough to satisfy the demand and the appetite as we continue to have an expanding retirement population that's seeking fixed income instruments and namely ones that are tax exempt. So that is, you know, kind of a bullish tailwind that still, you know, blows all of us that are drifting in the seas of munis. And often the technicals in this market can swamp fundamentals for good and for bad. And I think that this will continue to be a favorable tailwind that helps offset prolonged periods of rising rates. And you may even see where treasury rates increase at a greater pace than munis, and munis become, you know, again, rich relative to treasuries driven by technicals such as this.
Okay, sounds good. All right, Mel, do we have any questions?
Yes, we do have. We have a first question. Comes from the line of Travis Weaver of Weaver Consulting Group. Your line is now open. You may ask your question.
Hi, Travis.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Glad to see your Rochester team is building back up. I like the band back together. It's great. My question is around the average price of the portfolio, and just wondering why you don't speak to that more often. Is that really not from an expectation side of a big contributor for a return going forward? I'm just kind of where you sit right now because I'm still thinking you're at a discount.
Yeah, we're still at a discount. It's in the 90s, general average dollar price. And it's funny, we've had a long history, I think, of not really talking too much about discount based on bonds. I'm always focused on yield. To me, you're long term. So if you go back and look at our old funds, the Rochester funds of over the years, a long time horizon is very closely matched up, with your long run yield. So I'm always more focused on yield. The dollar price stuff tends to be a little more short-term oriented. And then there's some weird structural issues when you're calculating, dollar price sometimes in the muni market because of the, short calls and some of the other things. And then you have, defaulted bonds, that maybe some, and zeros, sometimes you have to make adjustments to that dollar price to get a true dollar price. What's clear on a relative basis, if you look at our fund at a slight discount compared to any of the other sort of competitors out there, I think there's a couple of things that clearly shows you we're a true, high yield pure play shop. We're not filled with a bunch of I mean, we do have some liquidity in the fund where you want to buy higher grade bonds that are much more liquid with $120 price in that nature. Because you could buy long threes right now that, you know, threes of 57 that are at discount, but that doesn't make that a good purchase just because it's at a discount. In fact, that's probably the thing I would least want to buy is a long double A, 3% coupon at a discount. So there's lots of just different reasons. It's not, I try not to focus on sort of dollar price.
Thank you.
Yeah, great question. And fair question. And I got to say, Travis, that's probably the most civil response to that question I've ever heard one of us give. So congratulations for that. Mel, any other questions?
Thank you. Again, in order to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Next question we have from the lineup, Irwin Mazur of Oppenheimer. Your line is now open. You may ask your question.
Hi guys. What percent of the first, I have a question that'll lead into my real question. What percentage of the portfolio would you consider non-performing bonds right now?
It's a little under 10%.
Okay. Have you kept any? I presume you have a strengthening economy. Do you feel that will strengthen the pricing on these non-performing bonds, or should these be amputated and gotten out of the way? It's like the patient died and nobody told them. I'd just like to get clarification on that.
Yeah, and I think there's different flavors within there. There's projects that will be we have. Like really in the last year, I think we've sold or as you would say, amputated a couple of the projects where we thought it's just not going to be a continuing operation and you're selling it for mortgage value. It's not accruing. It's not going to be a muni project ever again. And you just got to take the collateral and sell it.
Right.
So there's been a couple of those we've done. There'll be a couple more, I think, this year that'll happen. And then there's other projects that, if given a little more capital, a little more room to run, they can turn themselves around and start operating again and maybe, within a year start paying their, some significant interest. And in those cases, you get, A, you get the interest turned back on, and B, you would get significant price improvement in almost all those cases. I think there's definitely there's a few more amputees to go, but there's definitely a few of those projects that I think will turn around and turn into, coupon paying bonds. We have, again, I mentioned kind of the Puerto Rico Highway. Those are, we bought those on non-accrual. That's about a 3.5% position, knowing that was really a price appreciation play. They'll eventually turn into new Puerto Rico, bonds that would be accruing depending on the price of how those bonds are selling at the time when we get them, which will be mostly highways, probably won't get done until later in the year. That'll be a 3.5% position that'll start accruing income. We may end up selling the Puerto Rico bonds and buying something else with it, but that's money that'll get put to work generating income again. So that's one example. So you really, other than that, it's just one-off, projects. I would say, out of the other 6%, half are, some level of amputation, and the other half are some level of rehabilitation.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
All
right, Mel, who
do
we have next?
Yes, we have the line from Jimmy Forsythe of Oppenheimer. Your line is now open. You may ask a question.
Hey, Jimmy. Hi, guys. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, I didn't have my phone on mute so many times. Thanks for the call, guys. I like this fund very, very much. What's the maximum leverage you can take on?
Maximum is, 30%, 25-30%.
So if we get a shock in the system and you have some liquidations, you could, without selling the bonds at fire sale, you could take your leverage up, correct?
Definitely. I mean, we have a line of credit of more than, you know, 30 million, and we're using about 200,000 of it right now.
Understood.
And we're actually, that's something we're working on, actually shoring up some of that line of credit, which might actually increase it a little bit more to, you know, 40 or so.
Okay. I'm a stockbroker. I'm not really good with bonds, and I'm being forced to look at something as a substitute for short-term money. If you go through Oppenheimer's inventory, you can't find anything near 3.5-4% for short-term paper. So that's why I like this type of strategy very, very much. If I were to tell a sophisticated customer, the price of this portfolio is this with this much yield, as if it were a single bond. I know it's not fair to say that, but that's what that's how I sell it. Tell me what the price of the portfolio is right now. What I mean by that is if this was a one bond piece of paper, is it trading at 92 with a cost of 100? Is it trading at 78 with a cost of 86? Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's basically the dollar price question again. It's 90, you know, what is it? You know, call it low to mid 90s at a 5.25 yield is what we are right now.
That's perfect. That's a great way to sell to customers. And then you tell them, look, you got all this diversification and you've got the team, so it's not really fair to call it a bond, but that's how I sell it.
Importantly, it's also a 6-year duration. This isn't a 30-year treasury bond, right? It's
All right, so is there an embedded unrealized loss in the fund then?
Yes. So there shouldn't be any cap gains issues for any time soon.
Would you say 30 million worth?
I haven't run the numbers in a while. Quite frankly, I don't have the number off the top of my head. It's pretty significant. It's not something I'm even, you know, worried about. Like I said, we talked about some of those amputees. Some of those amputees give us a lot of, you know, if you sell something right at 40 cents on the dollar, that generates a hell of a lot of tax loss carry forwards.
Okay, great. I'm glad you brought that up. Do you buy any amputees?
Yeah, I mean, one example I just said was the sort of the Puerto Rico highways, right? We bought those at 36, then they're worth, you know, 60 today.
Okay, so let's go back to the day you bought that. And this is another selling point. I'm not questioning you. I'm just trying to understand how I could sell it better to my customer. I would not recommend a Puerto Rico piece of paper or any piece of paper trading at 36 cents on the dollar. But if I were, what's the advantage for me to buy it through a fund versus me buy as an independent investor? So in other words, is the Puerto Rico bond that you bought at 36, is it 36 bid offered at 37? Or is it – tell me about that story.
Well, one, you got to find the right – you got to – I mean, good luck to even finding that offering on your own, right?
And then, I know that. I know that.
And then, you know, having the knowledge base and wherewithal to know, A, this is where they're trading, this is where you can buy them, and understanding sort of the whole – everything that's going on in Puerto Rico and everything else to know with a high level of confidence that that bond is going to be worth, you know, 50 or 60 down the road. Most people don't have that knowledge. We have that's I know one thing well. That's high yield munis, right? That's what I've done. That's what we've all done here. You know, Joe Gully, you know, Charlie, we got a couple other credit guys. Our team has 20 plus years each of experience looking, trading, thinking about high yield munis, right? I mean, that's
I totally agree with you. I could argue that trading a municipal portfolio is probably more efficient to the customer year to the bottom line to the customer than buying a mutual fund for stocks. But let's not get into that. My real question is, if that customer were to find that piece of paper, could he get it anywhere near 36?
Not now.
Yeah, not now.
No, but, I know not now. But let's assume it came up tomorrow. If you're seeing paper at 36. Retail is not seeing it 36. I'm making the argument that you're giving me bonds.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, good. So that couple of points on 10% of the portfolio more than offsets the fees for the life of this investment, right?
Yes, and this is Joe also. The other issue that comes in, as you asked, is what's the difference between buying it individually or through a fund? Because when you buy it through a fund, you get instant diversification. So you're taking on that risk of Puerto Rico, but you're getting diversification of the fund as well that helps you if there is any kind of, you know, headway with that credit going forward, as well as your last point, which was the cost. You know, you have so much transactional cost being on a retail versus what we have on from an institutional side.
Okay, so you buy it at 36. That's your cost, no markup from there, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'd say if you're
I'm
retail,
not trying to beat you guys.
Yeah, if you're a retail buyer, it's somewhere between, you know, in that for that particular bond, it's somewhere between 38 and 40 is where you're getting execution.
Wow. Wow. I'm glad I asked the question, right?
Yeah. That's a pretty esoteric high yield, you know, trading, you know, it's a defaulted bond, right? The spread's on that a little wider. Then if you're talking at A rated bond or something, it's, you know, that spread would be a lot different.
Okay. Understood. All right. Now next. So you buy those bonds at 36. Now they're 44 bid. Do you trade them within the organization?
Meaning just interfund transfers within, you know, SMAs and funds and that kind of stuff?
Yes.
Yes. We're actually kind of, yeah, you can do interfund transfers certainly between funds. Pretty sure you can do interfund transfers between SMA accounts.
To cross that in the market, do you have to disclose that internally? I don't care. I'm just curious.
Yes, we have to do a three. We have to do a three bid process.
Got it. That's what I want to do. Through Trace or whatever. Okay.
Yeah. There's a whole
next.
Or you have to trade it at eval. You can't just make up numbers. You got an independent third party pricing of it, and you got to, you know, sell it at that number to protect both sides of the transaction.
Okay, and that's documented, right, because the rules have changed and all that. Okay, next question. Your mother refers you to someone who's got $1 million to invest, and it's suitable to be invested in the muni market. What percent of their portfolio would you recommend in this?
How old are they?
Not being held.
So how much money?
They're 62. They're 62 and a half. They sold their house in North Jersey, and they've got $1 million in cash, and the last thing they want to do is go to their local bank and get a CD for 1%. What percent of that $1 million would you recommend your mother's best friend to put into this portfolio? Let me answer my question my way. I tell them to put $200,000 or $300,000 in, and I know that's too much. But I have my reasons.
It's a know your customer thing, obviously, with all those legal caveats of know your customers. It'd be hard to say. You know, you got a lot of other details you'd have to ask, I guess. So, sorry, that's my
unfair,
my
unfair question.
Law
I'll give you that.
Talk to me then.
Okay. Final question. Let's assume Labor Day, the 10 years at 2%. That's what Oppenheimer's target is, 2%. What is my fund? What did my fund do to me?
You're pretty close to 2% on the 10-year now, or on the 10-year now. Is that what you said, 10-year?
Yes. I stand corrected. Let's move that out a bit. Let's go to 2.25. I stand corrected. I meant to say 2.25.
You're down around, call it 2% in the, you know, since the beginning of the year, and rates are up 50. So you'd be down another, I expect you'd be down another, 1% or so on the NAV, but then you've clipped your 5.25 coupon over that time period. Just say the end of the year that way. You're down 3% on your NAV. If rates rose a little more, maybe we're able to get, 5.5, in total income. So you're a positive, 2.5%, which is all income with some losses that you can use.
I love it. I love it. Okay, final question. You really sparked my interest with the senior citizen homes. Are senior citizen homes trading? Are they for sale because of COVID?
Yes. Couple reasons. There was a lot of they were very heavily it was a big part of the high yield muni market over the last couple of years, the years prior to COVID. They were building them out a lot, and there was a lot of new deals, a lot of newer projects. So there was a lot of good ones and a lot of not good ones. So, and then COVID hit, you had defaults, a lot of negativity. So, yeah, and then, you know, it's just – so people were heavy in them. They've underperformed, which caused people to want to sell more of them, and they're not – so the guy – the main five buyers, right, are very heavy in adult living facility, kind of senior living. When it gets cheaper, they're not really wanting to add because they're already very heavy in that sector. So that's kind of what's created this opportunity, I think.
I agree with your conclusion about it. It's a great long-term investment because more and more people are surviving longer and longer and longer. Everybody's got a friend who's got two or three friends that have parents going into these homes. Anyway, guys, great call. Thank you very much. I'm a big buyer of your fund. I like it very much. I'm even buying it for IRAs because what else? Oppenheimer's paying 20.02 basis points on money market.
Yeah, I know.
Not that this is a money market substitute, but with a pinch of risk, I like it.
That's a pretty big spread. Yeah.
Great stuff, Jamie. Thank you. Mel, do we have anybody else?
Yes, we do have from the line of we have a follow-up question from the line of Travis Weaver of Weaver Consulting Group. Your line is now open. You may ask your question.
Last question. Thanks, guys, again. One reason, and we don't use Morningstar that much, but we get a little slack back sometimes from clients, and one of the reasons is managers don't personally invest their own money. Are you looking at potentially helping that score go up just in belief? It would kind of help us out, too, just to make sure that we know that you guys are alongside us along the way.
When I took over this fund in late January, early February, I put over $1 million of my own in, and it's been in there the whole time.
Now, I don't know what – I'll get back to Morningstar.
Well, yeah, that's a discussion that we should have with them too, Travis. So we'll see if we can help you out with that one.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you. And we have last question or next question from the line of Jay Rick of Investor Choice. Your line is now open. You may ask your question.
Yeah, I got two hopefully easy questions for you. First of all, my clients have not received their 1099s yet for 2021. I think last year they got them by this time. Has there been an issue or problem, or what is the status on those? And then secondly, what is your actual percentage that you guys are holding now in cash versus kind of what you've been holding, you know, generally over the last, let's say, 2 years?
So the last, I think, 2 years. So I took over management. You know, this team here, we've taken over management about a year ago. Our general philosophy is to stay fully invested. I just try to, you know, it's about, to me, you want exposure to high yield munis. That's why we're doing this. So I don't keep a lot of cash. I generally try to stay fully invested. And like I said, I think I'm on the line about $200,000 right now. So I'm borrowing just a little. Occasionally I'll get into a little bit of cash. Just depends on flows and what's available in the market. But that's the general model. Prior to that, there were definitely – the prior year before we take it over, there were definitely some time periods where the prior manager had fairly significant, you know, cash positions. As he was kind of looking at high-yield deals, he would kind of just – hoard cash for a while because he knew there was a deal about a month, you know, that in a month that he was going to invest significantly in. So he would keep a higher percentage of cash. I don't really do that model.
Okay. And Jay, this is Nick Henry. I will look into the 1099 question and get back to you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you asked that. I was wondering that myself. I was just starting to look at that the last couple of days. Wait, I haven't got my stuff yet.
I'll get back to you too on that, Troy.
Yeah.
All right, Mel, anybody else?
There are no further questions at this time. Please continue, presenters.
All right, great. Well, thanks, everybody, for dialing in and listening today, asking a lot of great questions. As you can tell, we're very constructive on the municipal bond market and specifically the high-yield portion or parts of the market for this year, and more specifically, the way that this portfolio is positioned to take advantage of opportunities that come down the road from that market. So we thank you for your continued support and partnership. Obviously, if you have additional questions along the way, feel free to get in touch with our partners at SkyPoint, Eric Anderson, David Kalin, Brian Smith, et cetera, everybody over there who do such a great job. But otherwise, we'll look forward to talking to you again soon down the road.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's conference call. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect.